HoundsofHorror.com presents, once again, Night of the Living Dread podcast. I'm Otis B. Dreads.
I'm Malice Murphy.
We're here once again to talk about some pretty disturbing things, have a little fun, have some laughs, and maybe learn a little something. But, you know, before we, I'm not even going to tell everybody what we're going to be talking about. I'm not. Not yet. What I am going to do is I'm going to bring up this because I thought this would be good for some good laughs early on. Just kind of break the ice. Any new listeners, thank you for listening.
Thank you.
And maybe we ought to just break the ice a little bit. Have a few laughs. Break the ice. And we're going to be talking about ice cream over at ihorror.com. They have an article that actually came out like 3 years ago, but it still has the same humor to me. I don't know. It's like good luggage. It lasts throughout the years. Cool down with Ben and Jerry's horror movie ice cream flavors. Some of these are absolutely hilarious. Some of them are, well, I guess you couldn't figure out much to do with them. We're gonna start with this one here. Never Sleep Again. And of course, Freddy Krueger inspired. It's coffee flavored caffeinated ice cream. Good guys ice cream. Very small print. Cannot read that, so I can't tell you the flavor of it. We have from American Psycho, the original with Patrick Bateman.
Yeah.
This one is Patrick Bateman. This is luxurious low-fat mint ice cream with Godiva chocolate chunks and blood red cherry swirl. And on the front, it shows a picture of him, of course, with his crazy maniacal mouth open, wide laugh, blood splattered all over his face, with a little bubble like he's saying something. You guys know what I'm talking about. It says, "Don't just stare at it, eat it." There are some really good ones in here. Of course, we're not going to spend too much time because I will tell everybody while we're going through this and my page is loading, the movie of the week we're going to talk about is The Strangers from 2008. And I'm not going to tell everybody what grade we gave it, but it's so far, this is only episode 3, but so far this movie has gotten the highest grade of any of the previous two. Right. Which maybe don't say much, but I mean, it's setting the bar for movies to come. All right, more ice cream. from Fright Night, back in the 80s, you know, the old vampire movie. This is Cherry Dandridge with chocolate bats, cherry ice cream, chocolate bats. And here's everyone's favorite. This is a big hit down in Georgia. The Human Centipede, and I only say Georgia because Georgia's known for their peaches. Okay, not that people down there are doing this. Just trying to make a joke. Yeah, the Human Centipede, and under the at the bottom it says 100% organically accurate. So that there's a little vote of confidence there. I'm sure we have some fans of the movie They Live with Roddy Piper, and that was a good one. Do you like that one there, Malice?
I can't say that I've seen that movie.
They Live? Are you kidding me? Where have you been living at, my friend?
Under a rock.
Under a damn rock. Yeah, well, this one, for those who have seen They Live, this guy, this is your ice cream right here. It's called All Out of Bubblegum. Bubblegum flavored ice cream with chocolate aliens. And my favorite, and I'm going to end it here because I think this is a great way to end this. And you can, this I did post this up over at Night of the Living Dreads, that's without an A, D-R-E-D-S, .com. You can link right back to iHorror and read these and go through these. There's like four pages of all these different horror-inspired ice cream. I don't know if this ever happened. Have you ever seen any of these in the stores?
No, I wish I had.
Yeah, I haven't either. I haven't seen none of them. But my favorite, and we're going to leave it here, here's Brownie. Of course, from The Shining inspired ice cream. Eat ice cream with us forever and ever and ever. Chocolate brownie ice cream with walnut sprinkles. Yummy, yummy. All right. Now with that, let's jump in real quick to talk about this movie, The Strangers.
It's a good movie.
I'm gonna start with you. You start because we both are pretty even keel, I think, with how we feel about the movie. We're pretty much in likeness. Sometimes we disagree, not so much on this one.
Right. This is a great movie through and through.
I really couldn't agree more.
Great thrill factor. Like it's movies like this that really creep me out. Mm-hmm. You know. Really makes me question about going places and going on vacation sometimes because you just never know what you're going to run into.
And we were talking about that. Like, you know, you go camping and you would mess with people that you would go camping with and yes. Be like, oh, yeah, well, yeah, we're pitching 10 here, you know. But who knows if there's anybody creeping out in the woods who's been watching our every move, you know, just really trying to scare the living shit out of the people you're camping with. And I applaud you for that, sir. Yeah, I applaud really, you for that. That is absolutely awesome. I would do the same thing.
It's fun.
But there's almost an element of reality there that this, you may not be lying.
Right. I mean, as far as you know, there could be some crazy hitchhiker or wrong turn incestuous fucking satanic fucking stalker out there waiting
and they're all
waiting them tonight.
Yeah, mutants, you know. I mean, and that's kind of what this movie had. This movie had that, you know, hence the name. And I know people listening to this who probably think, oh, you're just now watching the, yeah, I'm just now watching The Strangers from 2008. I'm a little behind. I'm trying to catch up, man. My next one is what is it? Let Us Pray or Pray or something. Pray on the, I don't know, the next Strangers movie. I am very wanting to see now.
Yes, I
pray
can.
With us. Is it something like that? I'm making myself sound like a complete idiot right now, but that's okay.
It would be The Strangers, Pray at Night.
Pray at Night. I was close. No, I wasn't. I was way off. But anyway, okay, back to the movie. It had tons of jump scare.
Yes.
What they call jump scare. It had a very... the build up to the scares, which sometimes turned out to be absolutely nothing.
Right.
Were absolutely incredible. I can remember my heart pounding because I'm in this character's situation. And I can usually only do that if the acting's good, which brings me to my next one. What'd you think about the acting in this one?
I thought it was a lot better than the previous movies that we watched.
So far, yeah.
The characters were definitely showing that they were scared, showing that they were in some sort of trouble. And
right.
They really, their demeanor really related to the situation.
You could almost, you know, with good actors, you know, you can feel.
Right.
You know, what they're going through what they're portraying on the screen, if they're doing it well. And I did that a few times in this movie. It really had me kind of on the edge of my seat, if you will. It was a good movie. I'm just gonna say, I mean, there's not really a whole lot to, you know, really, you know, talk about it. You know, I mean, if you're like me and maybe you haven't seen it up to this point, watch it. We're gonna try and watch this new one. Maybe do that on an upcoming show. Pray at Night, The Strangers. I'm guessing that's like a part two. I mean, it the cover of it seems to be the same, you know, masked characters.
Right. No, yeah. It is.
And
it's the same masked characters, but I don't know if it's like a prequel or something. Or copycats. I don't know.
Yeah, because I read you know a little bit of the, you know, the plot, a brief description of the plot, and it was basically the same thing, you know, almost same scenarios of what we, you know, are seeing now. I think this one actually, that the new one that came out this year, I think that has a little bit of camping to do with it, you know, like what you were talking about.
Right.
So that kind of stuff creeps me out. I don't know. I guess, all right, I'm going to start. I'm giving it a B+. I think all around the acting was pretty good. I think the scare factor was there. There didn't have to be a lot of blood. There it wasn't overly gory. It didn't have to be because there were other things that were scaring you. B+, Otis B. Dreads. That's my story, and I'm sticking to it. What are you giving it, Malice?
I'm going to give it a B+ as well.
There you go.
It was a great movie. Not gory enough. You know, obviously.
It may not be for certain people's liking.
But the thriller was there.
The thriller was definitely there.
And I like, it's the only quote I'm going to say from the movie.
Sure.
But, you know, why are you doing this to us? Because you were home.
And why are we going to do this to our listeners? But we are going to take a short break. And guess what? I guess now I have to let everyone know why they should stick around, because this is actually a suggestion for the podcast by one of the Gorehounds of Horror Facebook members. Find them over on Facebook, Gorehounds of Horror and GorehoundsofHorror.com. Frank Massey.
Correct.
I put something out there about people chiming in. What would you like to hear a show about? This was his suggestion. Frank, your dreams are coming true, my friend. We are going to talk Lizzie Borden right after this short break.
Everything you wanted in life is coming up.
I certainly hope not. That I don't think he meant that. Anyway, we'll be right back. This is NightOfTheLivingDreads.com. And brought to you by GoreHoundsOfHorror.com. We'll see you on the other side.
Gave her mother 40 whacks. Once she'd saw what she'd done, she gave her father 41. Andrew Borden now is dead. Lizzie hit him in the head. Up in heaven he will sing. On the gallows she will swing.
Very interesting. It's very kind of, you know, gruesome. She was not like, yes, we're talking about Lizzie Borden. Welcome back to Night of the Living Dreads. Brought to you, in a sense, by GoreHoundsOfHorror.com. Great bunch of guys over there. And ladies. I mean, this is very, you know, mixed group with one love and one passion, and that is horror. You can find them over at Facebook. Just search Gorehounds of Horror. It is a closed group, so you'll have to ask for permission, but they don't turn many people away. There's always a long list welcoming new members, and we hope to see some more. So, with that being said, we're talking Lizzie Borden. And Lizzie, let's go over, so, because this is probably one of the most infamous murder mysteries in American history. In the world, I think, right up there with Jack the Ripper. This is and then more recently, the OJ trial. This is a very complex story, a great murder mystery. And we want to, again, thank Frank Massey for suggesting this, because this has just been really fun researching this. Why don't you give us a rundown, Malice, of the players we're going to be talking about, the dad, the mom, and give us a little rundown to give some of the listeners, if they're not familiar with Lizzie, a little heads up on what's going on here.
All right, we have Andrew Borden, who was Lizzie's father. He was born, you know, late 1822. It was actually September 22nd, who met his demise on August 4th of 1892. As we know. And Sarah Borden, who was the mother of Emma Borden and Lizzie Borden.
Mm-hmm.
She was born in 1823. She died 1863. She from a rare disease that she had got. Less than 3 years later is when Andrew married Abby Durf Gray, who became Abby Borden.
Okay.
She was born sometime in 1828. Lizzie Borden was born July 19th, 1860, and she died June 1st, 1927 of pneumonia.
Pneumonia. Yeah. And she as we'll get into, she was alone. It was kind of a very sad, you know, end of her years there.
And her sister, Emma Borden, she was the eldest sister. She was born March 1st, 1851. And she died just days after her sister.
Nine days,
June 10th, 1927, of kidney disease.
Mm. Well, there's some, is that all the players that you have for us? Or are those some of the main ones? We're going to get into, obviously, more players. But those are some of the main ones that we got going on now. Is that pretty accurate? Or do you have more there? See, ladies and gentlemen, this week, yours truly, Otis B. Dreads, did not do his homework. Malice Murphy, on the other hand, went above and beyond and has paper after paper of notes. I have absolutely nothing. So, guess whose back's going to hurt after this show?
There was their live-in maid, Maggie.
Oh, yeah. Old Maggie. Can't forget Maggie. Yeah, the live-in maid who will work her way into possible even a suspect. So, there wasn't a whole lot that really... And see, here's the thing. I want to preface this conversation before we get into, you know, some hardcore stuff here about Lizzie Borden. You have to understand this. A lot of this is speculation. Any of the research that you do on Lizzie Borden, none of it can be taken, I don't think, unless you do, you know, and it can be factually, you know, claimed. A lot of it is speculation. There's not a lot known about the inner workings of their family other than the brief stuff we'll get into. They're, you know, not like we've discussed in you know, the past couple shows to where we knew a little bit about, you know, the family, drunk father, violent father, blah, 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 you know. Not so much here. There's just a lot of speculation. There's nothing because of the time we're talking. At the time of the murders, we're talking 1892. Hasn't even hit 1900s yet. 1892. And so you can imagine what their forensic team looked like. You know what I mean? I don't even know if they knew that word then. I don't know. There were some, you know, Harvard, you know, doctors and whatnot, which we'll get into that. Probably pretty breakthrough stuff right there, what they came up with. But I don't know where I'm going with this babble.
I mean, I think it's the fact that there really wasn't a whole lot of information that we could find on Lizzie growing up.
There really wasn't, no. There wasn't really nothing to document. I mean, there didn't seem to be anything out of the ordinary. You know, why would you? It'd be like, you know, someone documenting you or my life, you know? You know what I mean? Right. I mean, nobody's out there doing that. I mean, we're kind of doing it here, but, you know, a part of our life. But anyway, yeah, there wasn't really a whole lot going on there. And, you know, not a whole lot that people know about the young Lizzie Borden. What we do know is that when she got into her teens, maybe early 20s, it was that around the time when she started doing the teaching Sunday school to immigrant kids.
Right.
I'm not sure how old she was at that point, but I mean, she was working very closely with the local church, with the community. Everyone knew her.
Right. She was the secretary treasurer of the Christian Endeavor Society. She was a member of the Women's Christian Temperance Union. And she was a
can't even read his own writing. My
ladies
goodness.
Fruit Flower Mission.
The Fruit Flower Mission. So she was very much in the community thing. She was doing good deeds,
right,
working in her church, doing all the, you know, organizations, maybe helping less fortunate, you know, that we do know about.
A model citizen,
absolutely. You know, those kind of things are documented, so those are the kind of things we do know. And what, I mean, where does it go from there? I mean, because at the time of the murders, we were talking, she was just about, what, 20-some years old, maybe? 20-some, I don't know.
30, she would have been 30.
She was in her 30s already, okay, so it wasn't actually long after that, what, when she was teaching Sunday school, you
mean? Oh, no, she was teaching Sunday school, she would have been probably in her 20s.
In her 20s, right, so... You know, it's not until she starts hitting her 30s. When did Abby come into her life? Because her mom, Sarah, as you mentioned in the beginning, running down our list of players in this murder mystery.
She was only six years old.
Yeah.
She was 6 years old.
Yeah. 6 years old, loses her mom, and later, you know, along comes Abby. How long after her mom died did Abby come into the picture?
It was 3 years.
3 years. So 9 years old, not even 10 years old, maybe close to 10. Here comes Abby and is in her life from that point on,
until that final day. She was 3 years old when her mom died.
Oh, okay.
And she was 6 years old when Andrew met Abby and married Abby.
Okay, I got you. See, I told you I suck at math. So, Abby's in her life now. Do we know anything factual? Because like I stated, a lot of what we read on the internet and maybe even see in documentaries is, you know, a lot of speculation, just a lot of theorizing about this particular case. Do we know anything factual about the upbringing from the time that Abby came into her life? What do we know about that? Is there a whole, is it mainly speculation too? Because that's what I mean, it's kind of a rhetorical question because I know at least how I feel about it.
There were some theories that there was a possibility of Andrew molesting Lizzie.
Yes, I've heard that.
But it was one sentence, and there was nothing else on the matter
ever said about it.
No, that not the research I was doing.
Right.
It just said it was one of the many theories that people were having.
Right.
I mean, I guess there was even a theory that Andrew had, you know, some other son with some other woman, and that he came and killed his father because his family grew up poor. And
interesting.
He was a pretty wealthy man when he was murdered.
Right. No, he was. And, you know, just a, you know, a quick heads up before we go any further, because that just made me, you know, think of this. In that time, River Falls, is that the name? Or
Fall River.
Fall River. I was close.
A little bit, yeah.
I was more in the ballpark there.
You were dyslexic.
I thank you. Fall River. yeah, there in that particular time, and what state was that?
Massachusetts.
That's right, Massachusetts. Durr. No, that's Durf.
Abby Durf.
Anyway. She, in that time, in Fall River, Massachusetts, mid to late 1800s, there was, you know, there was dominating wealthy families. One of them was the Bordens. Now, of course, they weren't all related. Maybe they were in some way, shape, or form. Just like all Williams aren't related.
Not to share my wealth with you related.
Right. Maybe that's true, too. That's a good point. But there were just a lot of dominating, you know, families in these small little areas. And you know, there was a big hill where all the wealthy Bordens and you know, cousins of Lizzie and whatnot lived up there. And, you know, as you mentioned, Andrew, you know, Lizzie's dad, you know, he didn't get the benefits of wealth growing up. He kind of grew up struggling.
Right.
And was a little, and, you know, didn't get that wealthy side. He had to earn that.
And he did.
And he did.
Yeah.
And he did very, very well for himself. I mean, he was worth quite a bit of loot, you know, on that fatal day. But, so, I don't know where I was going with that. Once again, where are we at here?
We were talking about Lizzie's family living up on the hill.
That's right.
And her father growing up poor. So, he grew up poor, was from wealthy descent. Made something out of himself, but he was very humble. Like, he didn't mind living without certain features and, you know,
and
commodities.
Did. No electricity.
No indoor plumbing.
I mean, things that they said that, you know, middle class people had. It wasn't even considered luxuries for middle class to have it. And here he is, a business owner, is doing very well for himself. But like you said, very humble. And yeah, they had what was described as an indoor outhouse. That's what it was.
Indoor outhouse.
And it was like, you know, a bucket, and you know, they would just, I guess, you know, just do, I don't know, live way below their means. But that was his thing. Maybe that's how he made his fortune.
Save money,
yeah. You don't have to live like that. This didn't sit very well, though, with a few of the a few of his kids, did it?
No, I think that maybe Lizzie, even Emma.
Even Emma.
were probably embarrassed, probably
a little resentful that he's making them live this way.
We don't have to live like this, and you're making us live like this.
Right.
You know, you're making it look like we don't have money when we do.
Exactly. And that was maybe a social embarrassment because their last name is Borden, which was very well known. Here's Lizzie, as we mentioned before, working all through the community, very well known, very good name throughout the community. And that's soon going to end. But, you know,
you're making us look like white trash. Shut up, girl, and knock your tooth out.
Damn. We do not advocate violence here at 9-11 Dreads. That was funny. That's good stuff. So, yeah, I mean, he's making them live this way, and it's very well, you know, kind of, I guess, documented. It's pretty much across the board. Most resources I've looked into about this story is across the board. Lizzie was very resentful about this. She wanted to be hanging out with the ones up on the hill. You know, when she did get a chance to go up there, they'd sit around and play, you know, board games. They weren't going to ballrooms and doing ball dancing and things like that, things that is what she wanted to do. How bad it affected Emma, I guess, you know, possibly right along the same lines as Lizzie. Who knows? We weren't there.
I wasn't there.
I damn sure wasn't there. I'm just trying to clear my name now. I was not alive in 1892.
As far as I can remember, I wasn't.
You're right. I have no recollection of that. I plead the fifth.
I don't answer questions.
Truth, you couldn't handle the truth. I wasn't screaming that, though.
It didn't count.
You're killing me, Smalls. Man, we got movie references going all over the place. All right, Lizzie Borden. Let's just really get up to the day of the murder. We mentioned the resentment, okay, that he had in the father. And then real quick, Abby growing up, or Abby being the stepmom now, the new Mrs. Borden. Was not accepted very well with Emma or Lizzie. It just wasn't their mom, and she tried to be the motherly figure, which I can understand maybe a stepmom trying to do. Gain the girls' love and respect, I get it. You know, I'm a step-parent, I get it, you know. But that was something Lizzie and Emma just wasn't having, and it seems to be very well documented, Lizzie more so than Emma. I don't know how true that is, if that is, again, speculation. So
they both did refer to her as Mrs. Borden. They wouldn't refer to her as mother or anything other than Mrs. Borden.
Mrs. Borden, right, yes.
And they had always believed that the only reason why she had married their father was because of the fortune that he was worth.
Right. And, you know, the name, you know, there was, you know, a lot of to be said about a person's last name at that time. There was prestige involved in it, you know. So there was, you know, that tension there between Abby and the girls, Emma and Lizzie. So
they're practically giving stuff away to Bordens. You see what she got.
Woo, caught me mid-cough there, friend. Thank you. All right, so now we're up to, it's a Thursday, mid-80s. A lot of people said it was just a steamy, hot day. No, the research has been done, and the weather on that day, you know, they say was probably around 80, mid-80s. With humidity and shit, you know. Maybe they didn't have the real feel then. You know, it feels, it's 85, but it feels like it's 322. But anyway, yeah, so, and it's August 4th, 1892. And again, we're in Massachusetts, and Well, walk us through, you know, maybe a little bit of the beginning of the day, because they had the day before, and we got to back up a day, because they had the day before, unannounced, from what I understand, an uncle, John Morse,
yes.
I believe. He's got a middle name that starts with a V, and neither one of us could pronounce this without wanting to punch ourselves in the face.
But he was the brother of Sarah, their actual... Their birth
mother.
Yeah,
so it was their uncle, basically. Yes. Right.
Well, he shows up unannounced.
Didn't even bring a toothbrush, I heard reports say. Didn't bring a toothbrush. Didn't you know, what it was just, boom, here I am. There was really no reason that people can find that he was even there, even though there was some business talk between him and Andrew.
Right.
But other than that, it was like gone. Very strange, but good. I'm sorry.
No. Well, no, the entire family was actually sick from what they believe was maybe food poisoning.
They thought it was, yeah. And well, now was this around the time that Lizzie confided in her friend Alice, saying that somebody had, she felt somebody was trying to kill her family, burn the house down, poison them. Was this before or after that? Do you know?
You said Abby?
No, Alice. Her friend Alice.
Alice.
She had a friend Alice that she confided in at one point. Maybe she was kind of just really smart and kind of, you know, covering her bases, making it seem like somebody was coming to try and hurt her family.
Oh, so you're talking about Lizzie.
Lizzie, yeah.
Okay, yeah.
And Alice.
Yeah, this is... No, I didn't read that.
Okay.
That's information that...
You are not privy to?
Correct.
Okay. behind the scenes humor. You guys wouldn't understand. Anyway. All right, so... So that morning, August 4th, again... The uncle and Andrew, Lizzie's dad and Emma's dad, they have a brief discussion, business related, for about an hour that morning or so.
Yeah, right after breakfast.
Right after breakfast. And again, you know, just a small little detail, don't know, you know, really what it means, but Lizzie very rarely, if ever, ate breakfast with them. That's how much she kind of despised, I think, Abby. I'm not sure if Emma didn't participate in breakfast, sitting at the table type thing, but Lizzie did not. And again, did not, you know, that morning as well. It's nothing really odd there. There was just some disdain between her and, you know, Abby. So John, the uncle, and Andrew, the dad, John was going to visit some other family members. Was it a niece, some nieces or something? He was going to meet back up with them, but it was some other family member, wasn't it?
Right. Yeah. It was supposed to be another niece, and he was supposed to also meet someone to buy a pair of oxen, which were like cows,
right,
or bulls or something like that.
If you're not privy to farm animals.
So, and that was around 8:48 a.m. That's what they estimated that it was around that time.
Okay.
And then, you know, it was around 9 a.m. Andrew left for his regular morning walk. So
now he also, just to clarify, he had also had been feeling ill due to the thought that maybe the bread was tainted or just bad bread or bad milk. Or
right.
Whatever.
That they had a few days prior to this happening, because, Abby actually thought that they were being poisoned.
Right.
And she went across the street and talked with their doctor that lived directly across the street, and he had concluded that, you know, you're just sick. You got, you know, you ate some bad food.
Right.
You're not dying.
Right. Maybe food poisoning or something. Not like that. Just you ate something bad. Your body's just going to reject it. You're going to feel like crap for a few days.
Right.
Okay.
So, yeah, it was 9 a.m. Andrew leaves for his morning walk. Somewhere between 9 a.m. and 10:30 a.m., Abby is walking upstairs to clean the room where John had been sleeping the night before.
Right, right. The guest room, yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm. And this is where she's met with her killer. She was face first with her killer, and she was struck directly on the side of her head, just above her ear, with a hatchet, where she had her body had turned when she was falling, mm-hmm. and she landed on her face and her forehead, mm-hmm. Resulting in injury to her face, her nose and her forehead.
And that's interesting. I just want to cut you off real quick, because that's interesting. A lot of people think that, you know, the story goes, and I've watched some small documentaries, some little investigative reporting, and they always make it seem like Abby was, you know, just hit. The first hit was right in the back, when actually it's not true. And I think you mentioned that she was first hit in the face. She was actually the only one that died that actually saw her killer.
Right.
Because they concluded that she was hit first in the face, and then the rest, the other 18, was it? Because she was hit...
what I read, it said struck 17 times in the 17. Back of the head.
Okay. And then once, obviously, in the face.
Right.
So we're looking at
directly,
18.
Like above the ear. Right. So right at brain level.
Right. So I just thought that was interesting, because I don't think a lot of people really realize that. They think it was kind of like a sneak attack, and it really wasn't. I mean, maybe it was, but she got caught, or the assailant got caught, and that's what she got.
And so, I mean, that could have had happened directly after Andrew left for his walk, or right before he had gotten home.
In that time frame of about 9 a.m. to about, what, say about 10:30 or so?
Yeah,
about
10:30.
An hour, yeah, hour and a half or so.
Because it was estimated around 10:30 is when he returned home, because he couldn't continue his walk because he was feeling ill.
He was starting to get sick just like the rest of the family. As a matter of fact, the maid, Maggie, you know, the housekeeper, she was also feeling ill, I believe, that day as well.
Right. Andrew returning home, he couldn't open the door. He couldn't unlock the door. The key was jammed. The door was jammed, and he couldn't get in. So he's knocking loudly for someone to answer the door, and Maggie goes to let him in, where she later testifies that it was at that moment when she was trying to let Andrew in the door and realized it was jammed, she could hear Lizzie laughing from upstairs. Says that she never actually saw her, but heard laughter coming from upstairs, and it sounded to be Lizzie's voice.
Right. There was another little story about that, that I've heard different accounts of that, that Lizzie was actually standing at the top of the stairs where she could be seen, and that Maggie was fumbling, you know, with the keys to unlock it from the inside, or was fumbling with the lock or something, and that maybe the laugh wasn't so maniacal, like, I just hacked our stepmother down, you know, I just hacked her up, smacked her in the face with a, you know, an axe, you know, but more of a, you're retarded, you can't even unlock a door, you know, one of those. And that was like a devil's advocate point that was brought up in this lecture that we watched a little bit of, about this guy who has researched this case for years. So he seemed pretty reliable and pretty dead on his facts. But anyway, I just thought that was kind of interesting that, you know, there's just different accounts to each, but I think there's certain similarities that we can say, yeah, this something like this happened. Continue.
Okay. And from what I had read, Lizzie, of course, and I being upstairs, her father asked her, you know, where's Abby? Have you seen Abby? And she'd stated that, you know, a messenger had delivered a summons from a friend that was sick that needed her immediate attention. Mm-hmm. And then it's really not that detailed. It says
because there's not a lot that a lot of people can, you know, put as, you know, actual fact from this point on.
From there, she claims that she helps her father take off his boots and puts on his slippers so he can lie down and take a nap because he's feeling sick.
Right.
it's at that time that she asked Maggie to attend to the convenience store, the little
of Speedway
grocery store that they had, the whatever store that they own, right. Said that there was someone there that needed help, and she instead goes upstairs to the third floor to lie down because she's feeling sick from the food that they had all had consumed.
Right.
And she was also tired from washing all the windows inside and out of the entire house.
Sick and tired of that job.
Which Abby had demanded that she had she do that day, and it was supposed to be very hot that day, so that added to
the aggravation
and sickness.
The, you know, I hear the humidity was, it was bad, and And it, you're already sick, so.
So it's 11:10 a.m. Lizzie's yelling for Maggie to come downstairs that someone has killed Father. And he had been struck directly in the face to where one of his eyeballs was cut in half.
So that's, where that's pretty bad.
They assumed that he was sleeping while he was attacked. And from the...
He was blindsided.
The bleeding from the wounds. The bleeding from the wounds, you know, from when people had showed up it pretty much immediately after it happened. They believe that it happened, you know, around 11 a.m. It was just shortly after he got home.
Right, yeah, because they approximate that he arrived home about 10:40-ish. Right around, a little bit after 10:30, you know, not quite 10:45.
Depending on what the sundial said.
Depending on what the sundial said, right. You know, so, yeah, I mean, and the way he was feeling, the way the whole, most everyone, don't have too much accounts of Lizzie feeling that way, though. Which is strange.
She didn't eat breakfast.
She didn't eat breakfast.
She didn't eat breakfast, and she rarely ate with the family.
Yes. And everybody got sick but her, which I guess some people who are pretty hell-bent on the fact that Lizzie did it, which there's a lot, you know, convincing things going that way, and there's also a lot of convincing things going, you know, other ways.
It's, right.
It's a very slippery slope, this Lizzie Borden case. So, continue. So, she, the story is Lizzie Borden sneaks in while after her dad is asleep. Now, mind you, as and I'm speaking as if Lizzie did it. I'll just put it that way. This is what a lot of people, you know, think. Okay. Lizzie killed Abby up in the bedroom,
mm-hmm.
up in the guest room. Abby was not seen for at least a good hour. Okay. And then that's right around the time that, maybe an hour and a half, that's right around the time that her dad, Andrew, gets home, tends to him, blah, blah, blah. He goes to sleep, not feeling well. That probably didn't take long to fall asleep. She then turns around and bludgeons, you know, the whole left side of his face to where they said it looked like minced meat is what his face looked like.
Right.
I mean, just gruesome. And unrecognizable, they said. If it hadn't have been, you know, for the other side of his face, what was left, they probably, you know, and then being in the house, of course. And then, you know, anyway, that was it. Where was Lizzie during all this, though? Well, I mean, what are some of the theories about, I mean, when Lizzie was obviously questioned, but I think we got to make note, she was also drugged.
Yeah.
Yeah, Lizzie needs her meds.
Yeah, during the inquest hearing, she was given morphine.
And even before that, the day of the murders, when cops, marshals, or whoever started showing up, she was also given some morphine then as a sedative to kind of keep her calm. So, you know, pretty much from the day of the murders, you know, she was getting some sort of, you know, morphine. But most importantly, during the, what was it called? The
inquest hearing.
Yes. And the reason that was important, because she was inconsistent. Tell us about that.
Her testimonies would constantly change.
Always.
So, as of her saying that she helped her father take off his boots and helped put on his slippers when he was photographed after being...
The crime scene photo shows something different.
Head being smashed in, he's still got his boots on.
Yeah. Very, very... I mean, and that seems... Oh, well, that doesn't really matter. Well, yeah, it kind of does. You know, it really kind of does. Because if you're going to lie about something so trivial like that, you're probably going to lie about some bigger stuff going on there.
That, but, I mean, and you got to remember she was given morphine. And that's, I don't know about you, but I've been on morphine before having some surgeries done. And
I have too. And
I've rambled off some pretty crazy things.
Mine also came with a surgery. I've had that. Which is, you know, comes to my next point. All these inconsistencies, they asked her, well, where were you? And, you know, were you upstairs? And I had to remove a dog from my lap. Anyway. You know, where were you at this time? Sometimes she would say, I was in the kitchen. I was out back at the shed, you know, getting some iron, I think it was for sinkers, because there was a fishing trip or something going on. Or I was upstairs. There were, like, different places. She was here. She was there. I was eating pears. Yeah, out back eating pears. You know, I can eat a peach for an hour. No, I'm just kidding. I really can't, because I really like peaches, and they're gone in, like, 30 seconds. Anyway.
Fresh peaches or canned peaches?
Either. It don't matter. So all different places she was, that was all not admissible into the trial. You know why? Because she was drugged. So they couldn't be sure of what she was saying was, you know, factual, or which part may have been factual. Which part of the house did she say that she was at? Was she really out there eating peaches? Was she really out there getting, you know? One of those could have been true. But the fact that she was doped up on morphine during this little hearing, which they said resembled completely of the trial, except she didn't have an attorney there. She didn't have any kind of lawyer, no kind of, you know, defense, nothing.
Yeah, she wasn't. The judge was, nope.
Yeah.
You ain't getting that.
You're a witch. But anyway, and the funny thing is, as I say that, I make that you're a witch comment, and, you know,
Massachusetts.
Yeah, well, not only that, but she was actually, the courtroom, you know, just exploded in applause when she was acquitted. She was loved.
Right.
But then shunned. But anyway, so yeah, they didn't take long for the jury, who was an all-white male. There's 12 of your peers. All-white old men with facial hair.
I'm shocked. I'm completely shocked that they acquitted her.
Well, it worked out for her, man.
I mean, I know it worked out for her, but 12,
well,
you know, old white men. Right, just true, like,
true. Yeah, I mean, I see where you're coming from then, but
this could have been one of us. Put her in jail.
Put her in jail.
String her up.
Oh, man. But see, the thing is, man, as we talked earlier, women, if they were going to kill somebody, would not do it normally through those brutal methods. Now, it may not be the case. You know, you got a lot of crazy female serial killers that are out there. I'm sure a few will discuss. This ain't going to be the first one. Not really a serial killer, I don't think, really. No.
No.
Just kind of like What do they call it? Parent side? Like killing your parents? Is that what they call it? Parent side? Something to that effect. Somebody out there listening will know what I'm talking about. Anyway, so... I hate my brain. It escapes me in the most inopportune moments. But anyway, he's distracting me, folks. I'm blaming this on Malice Murphy.
It's all my fault.
It is all your fault. But anyway, all white male jury, all facial hair. Don't know if that means anything.
I think it would. I mean,
really?
It might show age. There was nobody up there young, maybe.
True. Okay. Maybe you got a point. I don't know what that would, you know, what impact that would have on the trial.
Absolutely none, because,
right.
I mean, they acquitted her, so.
Exactly. So if it was meant to have an impact, it didn't.
Right.
And it didn't take long for him to come to this acquittal.
Right. Not long at all. Like 10 minutes.
10, 15 minutes, yeah.
And they waited an hour and a half because they didn't want to disrespect the Commonwealth.
Yeah, exactly. Right. And sat in the room, you know, for another hour or so, you know, because they didn't want to jump right out there and say not guilty or, you know, an acquitter. Because the main thing, the big thing was beyond a reasonable doubt. None of them, at least the majority, could not come to a beyond a reasonable doubt type verdict. So she was acquitted. Didn't fan well. Hell, she was shunned at her own church. She was pretty much shunned by the community, which might have been right around the time that little poem, limerick, whatever you want to call it, that you read in the very beginning of the show. Or actually, when we came back from, you know, our first little break. Yeah. I'm sure that's probably right around the time maybe that came out. After the trial, I mean, or maybe before the trial, because they're hoping that she swings from the gallows. But that didn't happen. So what did happen? It did kind of, I guess, what a lot of people would say would be motive for why Lizzie, you know, would take and kill her father and her stepmom would be she had this, as we mentioned before, this need, this just uncontrollable need, I'm going to put it that way, to live up on the top of the hill, up on the hill where all the rich Bordens were living, and live that life.
Get what was rightfully hers.
That's how she felt, that it was rightfully hers. Yes.
And she thought her mother was going to steal, or her stepmother was going to steal.
Stepmother Abby. Right.
Was going to steal that. Because, I mean, there's documented proof that both her and her sister showed, you know, points of anger towards their father.
Yes.
When he had given his sister-in-law, Abby's sister,
yeah.
A house, some property, probably some money. And they demanded property from their father, which mm-hmm. he had sold them a home that they had already been living in for a dollar.
Just to make it a legal sale, don't matter how much. But at that point, I guess he had to do it that way.
And it was documented, you know, weeks prior to the murders, that he had bought the property back. They had sold it back to him for around $5,000. And equivalent to today's cash, that would have been over $100,000.
$100,000 house, you know, by today's money, by today's market. $5,000 back then. So, Emma, being she was the oldest of the Borden girls, if Pappy dies, I guess, and Abby is nowhere around, the next one to inherit any kind of wealth would be Emma.
Right.
Makes sense to me. I mean, that's normally how these kind of things work, and that's exactly how it did work. Do you by chance have the figure? Because
yes, I do.
Her and Lizzie, they obtained a decent chunk of money in those days' of standards. And I'm sure you may have in your notes what that may have converted to by today's market, but what did they inherit? What did Emma inherit, who Emma also shared with Lizzie?
Was around, if not over, $300,000, which equivalent to today's money would be right over $8
million. $8 million, ladies and gentlemen.
$300,000 was a hell of a lot of money back in 1892.
Yes, it was. Yes, it certainly was. And they, you know, split that with Lizzie, as the story goes. They bought a house, and they lived together for quite some time.
Right.
I'm not sure off the top of my head, because again, I took no notes. I don't know the length of the time that they spent living together, but there came a point when Emma decided she was moving out, and this is where a lot of some more speculation comes into play. Was Emma in on it? Because Emma knew if Pappy died, she was next in line to get some money. So was Emma involved? I tend to think Lizzie did not act alone. Did Lizzie swing the axe? I don't even know that. I know she, I believe she was involved. I think it was maybe a group. What do you think? You think it was kind of a group of people, maybe two, three of them, maybe Emma and Lizzie, who kind of conspired to take these out, to obtain the money, to live you know, the way they felt they always should have been.
Yeah, I think that it would have been maybe John, Emma, and Lizzie.
I kind of thought John, too.
Maybe the possibility of
I don't know what John's going to benefit from it, though. I mean, that was his, that was, you know, the girls is Lizzie's mom's brother. I don't know how he would really.
He would have been real family. I mean, he could have been help feed the idea into their heads.
That's
like,
very true.
Like this, true. This outcaster comes in and tries to take what, you know, would have been rightfully your
right.
Your poor dead mother's.
I see. You
know,
what you're
you,
doing there. Yeah.
You're gonna let this. You're gonna let this woman come in here and take your inheritance.
Mm.
But it was
a
19.
Ask you a question.
It was in 1905 when Emma had moved from away from Lizzie, and it was due to an argument that they had over a party that Lizzie had given the actress Nancy O'Neill.
Yeah, I've heard. I did come across this story in my little research. Yeah.
And yeah. There, I guess there was also speculation. She was accused of shoplifting in 1897.
Mm-hmm. Yep. A few years after all this,
you know, maybe the urge to do something.
And she was always kind of known throughout this community as honestly being a shoplifter, because she would be seen stealing things. And the store owner, maybe there was a clerk there or something, and, you know, clerk be like, you know, boss, she's stealing. No, don't worry about it. Her daddy will pay for it. Because her daddy at that time had obtained quite a bit of wealth. So her, I guess you could say her shoplifting was kind of notorious in you know, River Falls.
What if she was just under the impression that she had a tab?
Fall River. What?
What if she was under the impression that she had a tab and people
kind of,
people were jealous, jealous that they couldn't have a tab, and were, oh, she's it stealing. She's not paying for it right now. She's stealing it.
Right. That's very true, too. That's very true, too. Well, my friend, how are we going to wrap this episode
I think.
Up? What?
I think that she did it. I think.
You think
she had a part in it. Like they're
kind of right there,
like the group.
Yeah.
Not for sure, because I mean it doesn't really much say about anything about John after.
No, don't. Just that his alibi of where he was with other family, visiting other nieces and nephews, that was considered solid.
Right.
That alibi was solid.
He didn't do it.
Emma's alibi, it was claimed, was rock solid. It was very solid.
She wasn't even there.
Wasn't even in the same town. Wasn't anywhere close. And all fingers point back. So you believe, yes, she did it, or at least was involved in maybe a conspiracy to take these two out.
Yes.
And or financial gain.
Financial gain, and probably maybe she just hated her dad for getting with this woman to try to replace her mother.
Right.
And resented
that, him. That resentment, yeah.
And, you know, definitely resented her.
I'm on Malice. I'm kind of on the same plane there. I think that she did not act alone. And as I mentioned briefly earlier, I don't even believe she... I'm not fully convinced she even swung the axe. Or the object. There's so much more to this story. You guys really have to look into it more. We have just, you know, tip of the iceberg. We've just... There's so many jokes there I don't think I should go to. Anyway, yeah, there's a lot there. I think that there was a conspiracy. It was financially motivated. I don't think she even swung the axe. But she knew it was happening. Maybe she did conveniently go to the garage as the assailant came in and did what they had to do, you know, to Andrew.
For all we know, the...
The maid?
The uncle. The uncle could have paid off the other relative.
What other relative?
The one that he was supposedly visiting.
Ah, very interesting.
He was there to do a business deal with Andrew that kind of got heated.
Yes.
You know, how else, you know, I mean, how'd he pay for the oxen?
Right.
How?
Right. There's just so much. I mean, this is a very interesting story. I want to thank Frank Massey for this suggestion. I know I probably speak for, you know, Malice Murphy over here when I say I thoroughly enjoyed looking into this story, talking about this story, just so much that we in the allotted time, which we don't really have one, but you know, we do get tired. There's just so much that we couldn't fit in.
Right.
So if this story and anything we talked about when it comes to Lizzie Borden intrigues you, makes you want to know more, please dive in. There's a lot of documentaries out there. There's a lot of written research that you can do, you know, a lot of articles out there. There's just, come on, we're you know, information age, man. You know, you can find anything about anybody. It's kind of that easy. Scary, but it's,
yeah, it's definitely creepy.
It is kind of creepy. All right, so I think that's gonna wrap it up. All right, how many times can I say all right right there? That's three.
All right,
that's four. All right, all right, all right. That's seven. Okay, we're out of here, guys. I hope you guys had as much fun as we did recording this here podcast. We're having fun. Hope you are too, and if not, shame on you.
Give us more ideas.
That's right, man. We need more ideas. I mean, we have plenty ourselves, but I think it's kind of cool.
I found more joy in researching something that someone else wanted me to.
Who wanted to listen to you? Right. You know, talk about.
It was more meaningful.
Yeah, sure. I agree. I couldn't agree more. It was very awesome. So that's right. Get them suggestions in over there. Find us over there at Night of the Living Dreads with an E D no A. Facebook, nightoflivingdreads.com. Hey, on the bottom of every podcast episode, there's what's called a discuss. You can drop us show suggestions. Hey, I tried it that time. there you can drop them there. We'll see them. We're there all the time. And at any rate, again, that was a great first podcast suggestion.
It really was.
I thought I really, again, had a good time doing this. So for Gorehounds, of horror.com. This is Night of the Living Dreads bidding you a farewell. I am Otis B. Dreads.
I am Malice Murphy.
We will see you next. Have a good week.
See ya.
Things no one knows. We're going to die.